Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
This radio documentary series, Youth Coalitions and Culture, is an effort by teenagers of City Academy Charter School to document various official and unofficial youth coalitions throughout Salt Lake Valley.
These teens chose to learn the art of radio documentary in order to understand what motivates youth to get together, whether for reasons of identity, culture, religion, sexual orientation, protection, or other.
An immediate goal was to expose issues facing youth, as well as to inform those looking for support in our community.
On a larger scale, it is a series that documents youth's time and place in history and in the community, including how groups and individuals are impacted by society and how they, in turn, are impacting society as a voice of the future.
My name is Francisco, and this is a story on my gang life. It all started about 3 years ago when me and my family were going through a lot of hard times, money problems, family problems, and stuff like that. I was really stressed out of seeing my mom crying over problems that we had, so much that I started hanging out with gang members. I mean, they would get me high. They would make me forget about all the problems I had at home. And about 2 months of me hanging out with them was when I decided to be part of the gang, Crown Latin Kings, and still am. But I see things in a whole different way now because I've been sent to juvenile detention. I've been shot at. My mom and sister got shot because of me being involved with gangs. See, at first, when I got jumped in, I was only 14, and everything seemed okay. The members of the gang didn't do anything I hadn't done before. We would get drunk and party. You know what most teenagers do nowadays. I understand. When I started hanging out with them, like, there's a lot of problems at home. Like, I was, like, on drugs, and my mom, like, found out I was on drugs, and, like, sometimes I did the drugs because there wasn't food at home to eat, and, like, my mom used to cry because we didn't have anything to eat, didn't have any money. I didn't like to see my mom cry, so I would just leave and just go hang out with gang members instead.
Oh, my name is Carlos, a.k.a. Flaco. I'm 21 years old. I'm from West Valley City. This gang was came from California, Pasadena. Now we're known, like, all over Salt Lake. We're close with each other. We have meetings, go party at somebody's crib or something, get beer, anything, you know, girls, drugs, whatever, just kick back. I did more than 3 years in prison, and all for the gang, you know. Been shot at many times, I've been beat up too many times, just a daily thing. But yeah, what goes around comes around.
Why did you get jumped into a gang?
Protection. Become part of a family, get respect, too many reasons. Have to do what you gotta do. The homeboy send you to do missions, you have to do them. Blast people, shoot people, beat up people, whatever comes up.
What does your family think about you being in the gang?
What can I say? They don't like it, but it's too late now. They gotta deal with it, you know? I mean, you can always get out of it, but don't risk it. You can't risk it. So a lot of things can happen to you. You can end up dead. I wouldn't risk it. Please wash me of my sins and let the scars remain. Cause it's death after life just to be a thug. Neighborhood
full of crime, gangsters, and drugs. Dear God, could you ease the pain? My name's Toker, and I live in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Why did you get jumped into a gang?
Just to be a part of something, you know. Have protection of those other people, you know, who wanted to get me, and I wasn't even nothing, but. But now I'm part of something, you know, or an army. It's an everyday war.
See, I didn't care if I went to DT. I didn't care if I got shot at. I was still very involved with my gang. But what really made me start to realize that what I was doing was wrong was the day my mom and sister got shot. When I first got jumped in, people would ask me what I was afraid of. I would always say of something bad happening to my family because of me being involved with gangs. And it happened. My mom and sister got shot with a shotgun at a confrontation with my gang and a rival gang. It was the scariest moment I've ever had to go through, because my mom and sister got taken to the hospital and I didn't know if they were going to be all right.
Pues llegó un niño preguntando por Francisco y dijo que, este, que si estaba él.
That's my mother, Rosa Mariscal. She's from Mexico and doesn't speak English.
Muy noche, yo pensé que no estaba.
Somebody came asking at the door for Francisco, and it was late at night, so I didn't want them to wake up my daughter. So I walked out, and they were looking for a kid named Carlos that was with Francisco in the backyard. And as soon as they came out, somebody came out of the car and started arguing and pushing Francisco and his cousin. And as soon as I saw that, I tried to go back inside, and I didn't get a chance to even go inside when I was hit by the bullets.
En los pies, en la espalda, y en las pompis.
I was shot in the legs, in my back, and in my butt. ¿Tienes los balines todavía en los lugares?
Sí.
¿Y cómo te afecta ahora?
Sí, tengo todavía los balines.
Yeah, I still have them in my body, like 18. It hurts me right now. I don't know if it's because of the cold or still they hurt.
Discutimos más, le grito más. Le digo que se esté en la casa.
We argue a lot. Salga. I yell at him more because I don't want him to go out anymore. And I scream at him more than I used to because I like feel angered kind of towards him because he was kind of responsible for what happened. Yeah, I've noticed that he's a little more responsible and he doesn't go out as much as he used to. I do worry about him, but I don't think he's going to be able to get out of the gang. My sister is 12 years old. Her name is Monica.
They knocked at the door. So, like, I didn't want to go to sleep. So I was trying to clean the bathroom. And so we both went out from the back because the baby was sleeping in the living room. And they were asking for somebody. So that guy's like, we should go now, we should go. And then this car came. And so we started running because they were starting to fight. And we started running in the house. So they shot my mom and me. I thought my mom was going to die or something like that. I just got scared. It's going to change her life. But I think when I grow up, maybe like going to get in my mind to be in a gang. Now I know that they're bad. So they're just people being killed for no reason because gangs.
An alcoholic, take my last breath. Don't let me die without reason. I can't afford to see my
I wasn't really thinking. I was just going through a lot of things that didn't let me think straight. But I wouldn't do it again because there's always good times and bad times. They'll go away.
I joined the gang to forget about the problems I was going through at home. And now I was having worse problems that won't go away.
For a while, I did regret getting in, but that wasn't going to help me fix anything. I knew I was too involved with the gang. I wasn't going to be able to get out. So it's just something I'm going to have to live with.
Rocks and now and letters, future hood rats and pigtails playing jacks, kung fu slippers, dirty socks that didn't match, elementary tears, playground war stories, shooting marbles in the sandbox for playground territory, socks for mittens, using cotton sheets for curtains, they say guns.
My dad is a boilermaker. Some people, when they hear the word boilermaking, they think of the whiskey and the beer chaser. It's much more important than that. My dad welds heavy metal items together.
Perry Orme's a good hand. He's definitely an addition to this organization. Perry goes out and does a good job and represents the boilermakers in a professional manner.
That was Jim Cooks. My dad went to boilermaking school at the Union Hall.
Perry, when he came in here, he was pretty sharp. He had a lot of the skills and a lot of the talent it takes to be a boilermaker already. That's why we kind of recruited Perry. When you see good talent out there like that, you go after it and you try to strengthen your organization.
Jim teaches young people, both men and women, to learn and appreciate what goes into welding. I hope to go to the school someday. I asked my dad how hard it was, and he said,
"It's not really that hard. It's more dirty and time-consuming. It pays good. $45,000 to about $80,000 a year.
The ability to fix things, to tackle major problems, not to throw your hands in the air and go, gosh, I can't do that. The people we recruit are people that see a solution instead of a problem. So Perry and a lot of these guys we bring in like that, the whole thing about being a Boilermaker is fixing things. And because usually when we hit the job, something is so messed up that nobody else wants it, and we have to go out and fix it.
When my dad gets a job, he takes off with it. Depending on whether it's night shift or day shifts, he gets to work around 5 o'clock p.m. and gets home around noon. But he likes it because it has good benefits, good pay, and the work is always a new challenge.
One thing about it, and I've learned in life, is if you're not learning something every single day, you've wasted that day. Perry's definitely a student of that.
I want to work with my dad. I love him, and it will be cool working beside him.
I want you to be whatever you want to be.
When I asked my dad about why it was important that we had welders, he said,
"It's the most secure way of tying two pieces of metal together."
Young people today don't think past the light switch, and I think kids my age should appreciate the work and thought that goes into the behind the scenes of technology and electricity, making this world light up for all of us. For City Academy, my name is Eric Orman.
Stereotype, a collective opinion based on little fact in a situation. With polygamy, stereotypes have been lit and spread like wildfire. Abuse, molestation, inbreeding, women who know nothing else being forced into plural wife families at too young an age. There are situations with such brutal relationships occurring. Colorado City, Arizona, is one of those places. Deeply religious and strict, families with more than 30 wives and 100 children cut themselves off from modern necessities. Television, internet, even women's pants have been shut out of this small, secluded area bent on protecting what they call the path to the highest reach in heaven. This is the perfect piece of meat for reporters to attack and rip apart, showing to the world the ugly, disgusting, and a repulsive face of polygamy, all of which, of course, is a stereotype. I'm here to show you the truth. I am in no way defending those of Colorado City, nor am I attacking them. It is just the perfect case for which to illustrate my point. The media often twists words, gives one-sided stories full of propaganda and what they want you to believe. In the general case of polygamy, it's often hard to distinguish the difference between truth and something made up from an imaginative reporter. In my story, I'm going to play the devil's advocate, showing both sides of something historic, something that is twisted in and out of Utah's history and present day. So when I walked into my radio journalism class at school, I was completely ready to make something real and concrete out of one of my ideas. This is my first radio story I've ever written. I've reached into the dark corners where nobody has dared to reach. Living in Utah and knowing our history, it's hard to understand and comprehend the facts without having a biased opinion. Polygamy is not a situation to be taken lightly. Every viewpoint matters, every fact has an impact. Take everything into consideration. Don't blow it off or discard it because it doesn't follow along with what you believe. To begin, I've thought about how questions about alternative lifestyles are rampant in the news today. Polygamy, the marriage between one man and multiple wives, is commonly practiced across the world. Should it be accepted as a viable option today? Should men and women be free to choose this lifestyle, or is it abusive and destructive? I interviewed two polygamist women with very different perspectives.
Hi, my name is Rowena Erickson. I'm a former polygamist wife, born and raised in the Kingston group, and I lived polygamy for 34 years, and I'm also a co-founder of Tapestry Against Polygamy. My parents were a part of the group, the Kingston group. My father, he was from the East, and he didn't believe in it. He just did it for my mother. And so I had two parents, and they loved me, along with my siblings. And I knew they loved my siblings. So when my sister and I engaged in this activity, I did it because I figured it's my job. I never fell in love with him. After I saw what she went through, it was the most hellish experience I'd ever witnessed.
Elizabeth Joseph is a polygamist from Big Water, Utah, and was one of eight wives married to Alex Joseph.
I was born in Bozeman, Montana, and raised as a very traditional Methodist. We were raised to go to college, pick a career, pick a husband, and go on. My two best friends, Bodica and Joanna, from college, had married Alex. And that's where you hear the media reports he had 20 wives or more. You know, he didn't. He had eight, period.
While listening to these women, hundreds of questions were racing around my head. Two incredible people were sitting in front of me. Two different backgrounds, two different personalities. All I had to do was delve further into their thoughts.
My own opinion is that polygamy is a sexual addiction. And people will argue it, whatever, I'm not backing down. When a man has one wife, and then he has two, he changes. And then when he has three, he has a full-blown addiction.
However, Elizabeth has a different opinion.
He was really empowering to me, and I felt like I was really empowering to him. That the eight of us investing our brains and confidence in him was hugely, you know, chicken and the egg. Was he that way and that's why we married him? Or was he that way because we married him? And we were satisfied to let it be a chicken and an egg, to go both ways, because I think that's the truth of it. That he was stronger and smarter because of us, and we were more powerful and stronger and smarter and independent because of him.
So who are these men? Are they addicts who demean women, or do they empower women to follow their dreams?
Super respectful of women. Alex is one of those kind of, I don't know, something unique at all, but guys really liked him and wanted to be friends with him. And women, whatever they thought of him in that regard, liked him. It was because he just so hugely respected women. He often said, I could have surrounded myself with a bunch of men to try to accomplish this mission, but women are so much better at getting things done. He was the dreamer and the, you know, he would envision things and we would execute them. And it was a nice combination that seemed to really work.
Most of the men don't want to be involved. They're running around impregnating their wives, not taking accountability, responsibility. They don't know how to love or nurture because it's impossible, nor do they want to learn. Like Paul Kingston, the leader of the Kingston group, he has about 23 or 25 wives. He has over 200 children. How in the Sam Hill can he take care of his children? He can't.
Right when I heard that, I immediately remembered the children. That's what amazed me so much about this. Everybody is so focused on the women, their experience, and how they are affected by a polygamous lifestyle. But it is the children who suffer the most. They're seldom heard from in the media, which is our main connection to their world.
The children are so boogered up, it is unbelievable, because they believe a lie, they've lived a lie, and they produce the lie. They really don't know what happiness is.
In fact, many polygamous women feel their children are better off in this living arrangement. Elizabeth says that her daughter's daycare is at home, where she has seven other mothers to love and nurture her. It's a support group that monogamous mothers don't have. I had just interviewed two incredible women, sure-spoken and strong, not afraid of the media, and not afraid to let the world know who they are. Their polar views left me with an open mind on this issue. There are two sides to every story, and so many people can only see the bad of polygamy. I understand all that Rowena said, and I believe that in some instances, polygamy is harmful and abusive. Most women are denied an education and a chance to explore the rest of the world. However, Elizabeth was convincing as well. I had never thought of polygamy and feminism in one sentence. Elizabeth is a vibrant and intelligent woman. She was able to be a lawyer, have a radio show, and still raise her children in a comfortable and loving environment. Something to think about. I'm Genevieve Stone.
This series was created by Susie Montgomery and funded by the Utah Division of State History. Special thanks to the insight and support of Kevin Jones. It was produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the arduous river crossing forged by Spanish explorers Dominguez and Escalante, which now lies deep within the watery depths of Lake Powell. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
One of the goals of the Dominguez-Escalante expedition was to find a northern route to the Spanish missions in Monterey, California, from the Spanish colonial stronghold of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Led by two Franciscan friars named Silvestre Velez de Escalante and Francisco Dominguez, the expedition never reached California, but instead turned back to Santa Fe, forded the mighty Colorado River, and thus created one of Utah's most popular historic sites, the Crossing of the Fathers. The Dominguez-Escalante expedition faced a choice in October of 1776 due to snowstorms and the untimely abandonment of their Ute guide. Would they continue to California or head back toward familiar territory? To decide, they drew lots on October 8, 1776, near present-day Cedar City, and familiar territory won the draw. Without significant direction, the party bumbled across northern Arizona throughout the month of October with scarce food and little water. They obtained food by trading with local Indians or killing their horses for meat. By October 25th, the group reached the Colorado River, just downstream from present-day Lee's Ferry. The party continued upstream, back into Utah, hoping to find a way across the Colorado River and out of the Red Rock Canyons. The group found a possible ford on November 6th, and the following day, Fathers Dominguez and Escalante chiseled steps in the canyon wall for a distance of about 10 feet to enable their livestock to negotiate the steep terrain down to the river. By 5 o'clock that evening, the entire party safely crossed the Colorado River and fired their guns into the air in celebration. The date was November 7th, 1776. The perilous ford became known as the Crossing of the Fathers, and the steps carved into the canyon wall were a popular historic site until the construction of the Glen Canyon Dam flooded the spot with 550 feet of water in what is now Lake Powell's Padre Bay. Nicholas Dimas researched and wrote this episode of the Beehive Archive. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And this is intern Elaine Taylor. What you're about to hear might inspire you to put on your hiking boots and conquer that mountain you've wanted to climb.
Or, for our City Slicker listeners, you might want to renew that subscription to National Geographic after you hear about the intriguing new research coming out of Utah State University.
Dr. Carrie Jordan and graduate student Justice Marath are studying nature's effects on our brain. We met in Logan's beautiful Green Canyon for this interview in the hopes that it would make us smarter, because, as it turns out, nature may actually improve our cognitive abilities. Jordan and Marath conduct research on this intriguing topic in the Multisensory Cognition Lab. Jordan is an assistant professor in psychology.
We're actually looking at how infants and young children might perceive different environments, so how they actually perceive different worlds that they live in, essentially. And we're specifically looking at whether they prefer to experience a natural or a built environment, and also whether they can even tell the difference between a natural and a built environment. and whether, if they can form these categories, whether they prefer to spend time in one category or another.
In their research, a natural environment is defined as anything found in nature, whereas a built environment is man-made, like streets, apartment buildings, and malls. Previous research has looked at adults' preferences for different environments, but this is the first to study the question in infants. Studying babies is important, says Marath, because they can help researchers determine whether a preference for a certain environment is innate or simply learned.
A handful of researchers across the country and the globe actually have been looking at some of these things in adults. It doesn't really get to the bottom of, you know, what's the fundamental mechanism of this. If we can look at it in a younger population, as young as infants at 6 months old, are looking maybe a little bit older, like toddlers, that kind of at least informs the question as to whether is there really an ingrained drive almost towards being in natural environments.
Researchers can't just ask infants what environment they prefer, so they've come up with something called the preferential looking task. Marath explains.
You can't do a whole lot with infants besides kind of a few different paradigms of things like the preferential looking task, where you're just seeing what would they prefer to look at. Do they prefer to look at what we would categorize as natural or what we would categorize as, you know, kind of built?
How do you measure things like that since babies can't tell you what they like?
So that's exactly why we can look at the preferential looking. And, you know, you put the way our lab is set up is, you know, you put them in a darkened kind of room, and then they have two screens available to them, and you're just showing them paired stimuli of a city picture and a nature picture, and these are counterbalanced and randomized also, and you show them multiple multiple sets of these, and then you can just time them by the amount of time they would say look at the city pictures versus the amount of time they would look at the nature pictures.
So if they like something more, they'll stare at it longer, basically?
Yes.
Later we met up in the multisensory cognition lab on campus so Jordan and Marath could show me what the preferential looking task looks like and better explain how their research on environmental preferences is linked to cognitive ability.
And right now we'll just show you the space where we run our experiments.
Yeah, so this would be our infant room. As we were describing earlier with the preferential looking task, where we would just essentially have the infants measure the amount of time they look at different screens. So in this room, we would just kind of darken out this room, and then the infant would be placed in a high seat right here in between these two screens.
The test for infants is set up like this. The baby, usually on one of its parents' laps, sits in a small blackened room. This is done to reduce distractions and make sure the baby is paying attention to the experiment. In front of the infant are two computer screens, each outfitted with a video camera.
And the parents are usually back here. We hide back here just to try it. What we're trying to do is also, since you're trying to keep their attention focused on the screens, you want to take out as much environmental distractors as you can, and then essentially we just randomly show them, you know, pictures of nature and city on these screens, and then with these webcams we can then just record and code for how long they looked at each screen.
As results from these tests emerge, it appears infants prefer a natural environment over a cityscape, just as previous research in adult subjects has found. But why is this important? Looking at pictures of nature may give our cognitive functions a boost.
So some of the previous research has shown doing kind of basic tasks of like memory and our attention span, like, you know, holding attention span. Also, there's now stuff coming out with things like creativity. So by having exposing people to various lengths of or various types of natural or city stimuli and then testing their performance on these tasks. And it appears that people will do better on many of these, you know, went after being exposed to nature versus built our control, just abstract stimulus.
The experiments on cognition that are run on children and adults are a bit more interactive than the preferential looking task. We move to a different room in the lab to see how cognitive functions are tested.
General room, through our computer-based tasks that involve children and adults, we'll run them on one of just basically a desktop computer. So they'll be set up, sit them down here and walk them through the process.
The participant will see either pictures of a natural or a built environment, or abstract pictures which serve as a control. After they view the photos, they complete a cognitive task.
An example of one is for the kids is we have like we call it the go/no-go task. Is it's kind of a intentionally taxing task where a bunch of animals will flash up on the screen, silhouettes of an animal, and then they have to just hit the space bar every time a new animal pops up, unless it's a horse, which is actually kind of difficult to do.
Yeah, so it's a test of inhibitory control, essentially, whether they can inhibit their responses, and it depends a lot on whether they can pay enough attention to inhibit their responses. That kind of inhibitory control in the past in adults and other labs has been shown to increase when adults are exposed to images of nature versus images of built environments. And so we're curious. It's an attempt at really a direct replication of things that other labs have done, but not with children before.
So that's just really all it ends up being. And then it spits out an output for that participant. Then we can we compile all the data together, and then we can look across each condition and see if we're looking at something like if they are asked to do a cognitive task after being shown the pictures, whatever it may be.
Does this have implications for people who live in cities versus people who live like here in Logan where we can go outside more easily?
That's a good question. To loosely paraphrase something I heard from Richard Louv, who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, talking about what he coined as nature deficit disorder. He said, well, if as little as looking at a picture of nature has benefit, then it doesn't mean that everyone needs to run out of downtown, you know, Manhattan, because they have Central Park there. Mm-hmm. They have trees. They have plants in their house. If just a little bit is beneficial, then that's, you know, it doesn't mean you have to run from the cities into nature. But then again, there could definitely be benefits to living in a more rural environment than an urban environment, but we don't know that yet.
Right now, we don't know why nature makes us smarter. It is a question that will continue to be studied.
Future directions of the Sensory Cognition Lab include measuring people's perception of time in nature and applying what they have learned from these studies in the classroom.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows.
Hi, this is Susie Montgomery. In our next segment, we travel across campus to a lab where new research is emerging about climate change on the Wasatch Front.
Robert Gillis, a professor in plant soils and climate and director of the Utah Climate Center, along with a few colleagues, had an article published in the Journal of Climate last month. The research focused on changing precipitation patterns in Utah. Gillis's colleague gave a presentation at a climate lecture that said variation in Utah snowfall was due to land use changes. This gave Gillis an idea.
When I was listening to the presentation, I then thought, that's counter to all the papers that I've read. So I went back and looked at the papers, and the papers didn't just look at Utah, they looked at the whole western U.S. And I thought, okay, so maybe it's time to actually look at Utah's climate and how it's changing from new perspectives as well as the perspectives that these other scientists had done.
Previous research primarily used either snow course data, which is a measurement of how much snow we get and how deep it is, or information collected from snowfall stations. These high elevation weather stations look at trends in precipitation patterns. Gillis took a different route to gather data.
So I thought, well, okay, we really need to look hard at Utah. And we're not going to look at snow course data, and we're not going to look at the snowtell data sites. We're going to use the historical climate network, and then we're also going to use satellite data. We're going to use gridded data products, and we're also going to use new techniques of actually looking at the weather systems that bring these stations in.
The data took over 2 years to analyze.
So the results that we came forward with were kind of interesting. For northern Utah, for example, there's more precipitation coming in over time. So since the beginning of the analysis, say in the 1950s, well, the historical analysis went back even further than that. But as we looked at the trends, we saw that more precipitation was coming into northern Utah. but when you break down the precipitation into snow and rainfall, so you actually have what's called the snow to precipitation ratio. As that declines, that means you're either getting less snow or more rainfall or both. The snow to precipitation ratio has been declining by about 13%. And the reason for it is that it's coming as there's more rainfall coming into northern Utah.
Snowfall may also actually be declining, but it does not appear to be statistically significant. Changes in weather patterns, which are responsible for bringing rain and snow to Utah, were also looked at in the research. The two primary types of patterns are trough, which Gillis described as U-shaped constant pressure sitting above the ground surface, and subtropical.
When we looked at the trough type, we saw a significant decline in the number of trough instances. With the subtropical type, it wasn't the case, right? So what has happened then is that the number of troughs that bring in the weather into the state, and in the northern part of the state for sure, has declined significantly.
Less trough patterns would usually mean less precipitation. However, as Gillis explains, that is not the case.
Weather events, i.e. the rainfall events, were more intense. So more rain is being dropped by the systems that are coming in, even though they're declining.
Weather patterns aren't the only thing changing in Utah. Gillis explains.
When we looked at the satellite data for snow coverage and snow depth, they have been declining over time, even though the snow amounts haven't been declining significantly. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that the snow is melting off earlier and quicker.
Snow melt may be due, in part, to changes in maximum and minimum temperatures across the region and seasons, which, according to historical data collected over the past 50 to 100 years, has been increasing. Additionally, rain falling on snow makes it melt even faster. So what's causing all of this, and how will it affect the people of northern Utah?
How will this changing weather pattern affect people locally?
Well, we all rely on water, right? And we rely on water for culinary uses, but we also rely on water for industry, for generation of power. We rely on water for agriculture, both in food, crops, but also livestock. Everything relies on water. So snow is really important for your water resources. Now, if that is now changing, it's declining somewhat, but it's also melting faster and earlier in the season, and more precipitation is coming, your whole hydroclimate has changed. So you're no longer getting the snow percolating nicely down into the groundwater, and then you tap that groundwater for your resource, right? For your culinary use, etc., etc., etc. Now what is happening, okay, is the water comes down as rain and runs off immediately. It all comes down to water resources and how they're used. Water can be scarce and you don't have enough to use it, or you can have too much and then it causes all sorts of other problems. But then, you know, you've got lots of water, but you don't capture it, and then you might go into a drought later on in the season because it's still very warm, but that water that was there has gone. You can only store much in a reservoir.
A result of increased precipitation and melting of snow may be flooding. Not only does this hurt residential areas, but it can significantly hurt farming in the region.
If you've got a flooded farm, you can't plant crops. So last year, for example, not only because of the water flooding, but also because of the temperatures, they couldn't plant the crops when they normally would do. So they planted the crops later. So then it became very important to the farmers that we work with was, you know, how long can we keep that crop there before we get the first freeze?
Not only does early melting of snow increase the risk of flooding in the area, it may also change entire ecosystems and lead to other problems, such as fires.
If you have a very slow melt-off, okay, that keeps the ground cool for a longer time. And this is very relevant for this season, where we've had all these wildfires. if the snow melts off quicker, then the sun's radiation or the sun's rays can get onto the ground and heat that ground up more quickly and earlier in the season. And that means then that any plants that are there will have less water, for example, than they usually would have over that period of time. So then you could basically say that snow on the ground is the nice refrigerator effect. If the pattern continues, let's think about it, you're going to get more precipitation as rain, less as snow. You're going to have an earlier and earlier runoff and, well, melting runoff and warming up. So potentially you're shifting the season slightly earlier, which has sort of been the case this year. That starts to affect whole ecological systems.
Gillis says things like insect cycles, flowering of plants, and bird migrations may shift to earlier in the season. This may also push animals and plants into different elevations, putting new pressures on many species. Although the paper does not directly attribute the changes seen in their data to climate change, mostly because they are inferring trends from 70 years' worth of weather patterns, Gillis does suggest that increases in temperature and extreme weather patterns are representative of predictions for global warming in the region.
So we've got all these extreme events with major destruction. These are the things that the climate scientists were saying 10 years ago are a result of global warming. So global warming is all about energy exchange on the planet. So if more energy comes in and less leaves, the planet will warm up. If less energy comes in and more leaves, it will cool down. So as we trap more energy of the energy that comes in from the sun on the planet, then the temperature will go up. And I have no equivocation whatsoever in saying when you look at NASA's data for global temperatures and you look at NOAA's data for global temperatures, since the 80s, the trend of temperature has been increasing and increasing at quite an alarming rate. Okay, so the planet's warming up, and that is global warming. And there's no doubt about in climate scientists' minds that that's the case. You can't statistically attribute these things to global warming, but the evidence is mounting to suggest that indeed the regional effects are such and are linked to this energy, this energy imbalance compared to what has been the case in the past.
If Gillis's research is correct, Utah's weather and resources will be changing significantly in the coming years.
Are you hoping that this article helps prepare the state of Utah for what is to come when they make decisions about collecting water or doing emissions testing, all sorts of things that they have options for?
Yeah, and it already is occurring. I mean, we're having the water managers come up to Utah State University for a colloquium next week. Many people have already requested a copy of the paper, and our paper isn't the only paper. There are many papers out there. The water managers are now starting to think about risk management strategies because, as you know, as we've already discussed, we have things that we can describe within natural variability, but there is the possibility now that we're out with that natural variability. And so the water managers are starting to make plans for a risk management plan to say, least case scenario, worst case scenario, what do we need to do so that you have a plan of action in place, then maybe in the next 5 years' worth of data, we'll be able to say more definitively, you know, where things are going. But the bottom line is temperatures increasing, snowfall not necessarily decreasing, more precipitation, meaning more water resources, but a different form of water resource, so the hydroclimate has changed. And then when you sort of bring it all together in terms of the melt-off in the spring season, you know, April, May, then the warming of the atmosphere is accelerating that, along with these other effects that I was talking about, windy conditions and condensation in a high humidity environment, which releases a lot of heat.
J. Changes in regional weather patterns mean variable, intense, and less predictable weather for the Wasatch Front. Using this comprehensive research as a tool may help the state prepare for and adapt to a warming climate. For more information, visit climate.usurf.usu.edu.
Forests cover one-third of Utah, and they are one of the most valuable resources on the planet because they are renewable and they provide oxygen for our Earth. But we rarely see them in our headlines. Today, SQ brings you part one of the series More Than a Tree from member station KUOW. This series highlights five trees that deserve a closer look. We learn about a tree that has orbited the moon, a tree that can fight cancer, and a tree that has sperm. Yes, sperm. For part one, we travel to the Capitol campus in Olympia, Washington. In 1971, an astronaut took about 500 seeds to the moon. One of those seeds ended up in Olympia. Sarah Waller of KUOW visits the moon tree 41 years after its lunar orbit to find out why its future is uncertain.
3, 2, 1, we have liftoff.
On January 31st, 1971, Apollo 14 roared into the clear blue sky. Its destination, the moon.
Roger, roll complete.
Humans had only landed there twice before. Each of the three astronauts on board had a small nylon pouch containing personal items they wanted to take into space.
In Houston, everything looks good here on the ground.
Edgar Mitchell took a patch from his college fraternity. Alan Shepard brought golf balls, two of which he famously smacked off the lunar surface into space.
Miles and miles and miles.
But command module pilot Stuart Roosa brought tree seeds. About 500 of them. Because before Stuart was an astronaut, he was a smoke jumper with the U.S. Forest Service. He worked in the Pacific Northwest fighting forest fires. He loved the woods. So when the Forest Service approached NASA about taking tree seeds into space, Stuart stepped forward. He took them in his personal kit, and that meant carrying them a long, long way. I called NASA to find out just how far those seeds traveled.
Dave Williams?
That's Dr. David Williams. He's a space scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Center. He watched the launch of Apollo 14 mission as a kid.
Well, the distance to the moon from the Earth is roughly about 240,000 miles, but you don't go straight there. You kind of follow this big circular trajectory.
Once in the moon's orbit, the seeds circled 34 times with Stuart in the command module, while the other two astronauts walked on the moon. Then they came back to Earth. The seeds had traveled about 1,000,000 miles. NASA put them in a vacuum chamber as part of the decontamination process. That's where things almost went wrong.
The pressure was too much for the canister and it burst open. So all the seeds came flying out and were all instantly exposed to a vacuum. So the fear was that they killed the seeds.
But just in case, NASA sent the seeds to the Forest Service to see if any had survived. They had. In fact, almost all of them sprouted. They were healthy and didn't seem any different from a group of control seeds that had stayed back on Earth. So the Forest Service started giving the moon trees away. One sapling was planted at the White House, another at Valley Forge. Another one was given to the Emperor of Japan. And one ended up right here in Olympia at the main entrance to the Capitol campus. It's a Douglas fir. It's about 40 feet tall now. You can see the Capitol dome rising behind it.
This Douglas fir tree grows too large to even be this close to a street. Something will need to change.
Ray Gleason is an arborist. He was called in last summer when cracks started showing up in the sidewalk next to the moon tree. He did some excavation around the roots and found they were boxed in by a busy street on one side and a sidewalk on the other. And for a tree species that's the third tallest in the world, that's like trying to raise a whale in a fishbowl. Ray fears that within 50 years, the tree will die of root rot if something isn't done to give its roots more elbow room.
We need to change the roads and the sidewalk here sooner or later.
The layout of the sidewalk is part of a grand plan, and it's not something you just tinker with.
That's Mary Grace Jennings. She's the cultural resource manager for the state. She says saving the moon tree is not as simple as moving concrete. The sidewalks surrounding the tree were designed by two famous landscape architects, the Olmsted brothers, one of whom helped design Central Park. So moving this sidewalk would mean changing a key design element in the Olmsted's historic plan.
And that was really something I was pretty reluctant about. I'd like the tree to last as long as it can, but it is planted in an urban setting.
The state didn't change the Olmsted design. However, they did give the tree a little extra space by shifting the location of a wheelchair ramp. But new cracks are already starting to show. No one knows exactly how long the moon tree in Olympia can live in its current location. One proposal is to use seeds or grafts from the original tree to plant a second-generation moon tree in a better location. But David Williams at NASA says that every time a moon tree is lost, we're losing more than a tree.
Well, it's like a living artifact. The astronauts and all the people who worked on Apollo back then, they're disappearing now. So it's very possible that the moon trees at some point, 20, 30 years from now, the moon trees will be the only living things that have ever been to the moon.
The astronauts are now safely inside the command module. Tonight they'll fire out of lunar orbit and head for splashdown in the Pacific Tuesday afternoon.
I'm Sarah Waller for KUOW.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor.
Thanks for listening.
That was good.
Support for Science Questions is provided by the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll dance the tango in its many forms, from the traditional bandoneon of Argentina to the pulsing electronica of the new tango of Finland and Norway. I'm Rosalie Howard. Join me for Tango Around the World, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 o'clock. Thank you.